I'm Gene Pasale, and this is Living History. This show explores the rich heritage of the Brandywine Valley, focusing on the people, places, and events over more than 300 years, which have played an important part in our American heritage. Each show highlights a local town, event, or personality who has had a notable influence on our culture. Before we get going, I want to remember to tell people about the call-in number. The call-in line is 610-701-9243 if you have questions. This day in history. On this night in 1777, Philadelphia nurse Lydia Dara supposedly overhears British officers planning an attack on the Continental Army. She later gets through a line of British soldiers guarding the city in time to warn George Washington and his troops, who fought a skirmish with the enemy just a few days later at White Marsh. In 1804, Pope Pius VII crowns Napoleon Bonaparte as Emperor of France. And in 1823, during his annual address to Congress, President James Monroe announces what would be termed the Monroe Doctrine, warning other nations to avoid interference in U.S. operations in the Western Hemisphere. In effect, a hands-off statement that would become an important part of U.S. foreign policy for decades. Today's guest is Michael Newton. Michael lives in Phoenix, and he's going to be joining us by phone. He's written an excellent new book on one of the most important of the founding fathers, Alexander Hamilton. His book is titled Alexander Hamilton, The Formative Years, and it delves into numerous details of his life, which has sometimes been misunderstood or simply inaccurately reported for many years. Most people know Hamilton from his place on the U.S. $10 bill, which is currently under review. But his place in U.S. history goes far beyond our currency. Hamilton was a patriot soldier, an aide-de-camp to General George Washington, a major contributor to the Federalist Papers and the U.S. Constitution, and our first Secretary of the Treasury. He was at the most significant person to be an architect of the American financial system. He was also a major contributor to our young republic. Most people know Hamilton because he was in a play on Broadway recently in the last few months. He's gotten a lot of attention. He's also continued to be a subject of speculation as to whether he's going to be taken off the $10 bill or not, which is annoying a lot of Hamilton fans. And I have to admit, personally, I have a very strong interest in Alexander Hamilton because I've done a lot of research on him, and I'm also earning a master's degree in American history where I'm focusing on the early American Republic. So, you know, I have an interest in Alexander Hamilton just because he is such an important contributor to our early republic. And I think many people would have to say that Hamilton is just one of the most important contributors to our system of government, our Constitution, the financial banking system, and just about everything else you can think about America. So today we're going to be talking to an expert on Alexander Hamilton, Michael Newton. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Gene. It's a pleasure to be on.
Yeah, thank you for joining us. Not many people know about Hamilton's background, where he grew up, when he came to the colonies, etc. Can you highlight some of the most important details you consider to be crucial for his life?
Just to get a quick understanding, he was born in 1757 on the island of Nevis in the West Indies, the Caribbean. He lived there until 1765, so he's 8 years old. They moved to St. Croix. Shortly afterwards, probably 1766, his father leaves. 2 years later, his mother dies, so he's essentially an orphan at the age of 11. He goes to work for a mercantile company, impresses his boss, writes for the newspaper, a brilliant essay on the hurricane that occurred in 1772, and as a result of his hard work and everybody noticing it, he's sent to New York, to North America, the mainland, to get an education, and so that's how he came to the country. So this is 1772. He's just about turning 16 years old.
Now, in my research on Hamilton, I was fascinated by the fact that at the age of, what, about 13 or 14, he was in effect running this trading company in St. Croix, owned by, I guess, Beekman and Kruger. As such a young kid running the entire company, I guess he must have shown his brilliance to the proprietors.
Yeah, he had worked for the company for a few years as a clerk. Well, he probably started as an errand boy, worked his way up to a clerk, and then the head of the company, Nicholas Kruger, got sick and went to New York, and he left Alexander Hamilton, who, as you said, so this is 1771, so he's 14 years old. He leaves him in charge of the company, and we can see much of what Hamilton does by the letters that, you know, there were copies of the letters that he wrote, and you can see him dealing with ship managers, merchandise, currencies, with the Coast Guard, basically, of the mainland, and he's basically running the entire operation from St. Croix for 5 months. And his boss then comes back. He's doing much better. He comes back, and he writes that he agrees with everything Hamilton did. Hamilton did a great job, and apparently the company did perfectly under Hamilton. And that, of course, is what impressed not just his boss, but everybody on the island to then raise a subscription to send him to get a real education.
Yeah, it's pretty fascinating that such a young kid could run a trading operation. I think that's testimony to his brilliance. Hamilton did serve in several battles of the Revolution, and many of them were kind of in the Mid-Atlantic area. Can you discuss some of what you consider the most important battles he served in?
Well, there would, in terms of battles, there would be three distinct periods of time. There's first, he was an artillery captain for an artillery company in New York, and he served then in New York City when the British came in. He was not in the Battle of Long Island. He was then in the retreat out of New York City, the retreat up to White Plains and over, and then the retreat entire through New Jersey. And then, of course, you know, Washington brings the troops over the Delaware River, attacks first the Hessians in Trenton, and then the British in Princeton, and Hamilton's involved in both of those two battles. That's as an artillery captain. Then he gets noticed by Washington during that period. He becomes an aide to Washington. And as an aide to Washington, wherever Washington's in battle, Hamilton's in battle. So he's at the Battle of the Brandywine, the Battle of Germantown, the Battle of Monmouth, and on and on. Some of these, you know, we don't know what, if anything, he did. He's an aide to Washington. He's riding with Washington, delivering messages. In other cases, there are accounts of what Hamilton did, how Hamilton would, you know, see something going wrong, and he would run over there and reorganize the troops. So he was, you know, even though he was an aide, you know, his job was really to write letters. You see him commanding troops, even though he's not in a command position. Then, towards the end of the war, he's no longer an aide to Washington, so this is the third phase. He's given command of a battalion. And this battallion, at the time, the army is on the Hudson River in New York, and then they march all the way down to Yorktown. And Hamilton is given the command to assault Redoubt 10, which is the, you know, ultimate battle in this long siege. And by capturing the redoubt, it, you know, cinched the deal that Yorktown would fall. And Hamilton led that command and was widely recognized for his, you know, his brilliance in command, but also his lenity for the soldiers that he captured.
You know, Hamilton was in or pretty close to several of the skirmishes or big battles of the Revolution. Was he ever wounded?
I'm not sure if you would ever call it being wounded. And the most notable one is at Monmouth. He was reconnoitering for 5 days before the battle. Then he had his horse shot out from under him. And as a result of that injury and previous fatigue, he was forced to retire from the field. He wasn't really wounded. You know, he wasn't shot. He didn't, as far as we know, he didn't break any bones. You know, but having a horse fall down on you, of course, you're injured, but not necessarily wounded. More broadly, after many of these periods of intense work, you know, he goes on a mission for Washington to upstate New York for a number of days, the Battle of Monmouth. He would often get sick for extended periods of time afterwards. And, of course, you know, you're riding 50 miles a day in snowstorms for days on end, and you return and you're just, you know, fatigued and overwhelmed, and you caught a cold or the flu, or you're just, you know, too tired. And, you know, you'd often be out of commission for a few days or even even for a few weeks.
Mm-hmm. I think it's a kind of a similar story with Washington. I don't believe Washington was ever wounded in battle, was he?
He was never wounded in battle, but again, I can only think of one at the time, but there were periods where he was sick. He was never shot. His coat was shot, you know, famously, but he was never shot. So neither of them were ever wounded in battle. I guess they were both blessed that way.
Yeah.
Washington, of course, is famous for, you know, being so close to the action and never getting wounded. But, you know, the same applies to Hamilton.
Yeah, which I think is not quite a coincidence. There's got to be something special going on there. I know that after speaking with General Washington himself a little while back on the show, a guy named Carl Kloss, who plays Washington all over the country as a living biographer, Washington was very particular about the people he brought onto his staff. It was a meritocracy of ideas and accomplishments. Apparently, Washington thought extremely highly of Hamilton and his abilities. Could you comment on that?
Yeah, Washington was very picky. He would, before anybody can come to work for him, he had to have recommendations from others, people he trusted, gentlemen he trusted. Then even when they came on, there was often like a weeding out process. So some of the aides came on, they didn't last too long. Aides came on, and then he would realize what their strengths and weaknesses. Some, you know, would just write letters. Others would, you know, be given more missions and field assignments. So he would learn and continue to adapt. He had many aides that were helpful. Hamilton's name obviously rises to the top. He was actually the third longest serving aide. He wrote the third most number of letters. That doesn't mean, you know, he might have written more important letters than the others. He had a good team, and when you list the people who worked for him besides, you know, Hamilton, you had James McHenry, who was later Secretary of War. You had people like John Lawrence, who, if he wouldn't have died in 1782, would have gone on, I think 1782, would have gone on to bigger things. There were others. Robert Hanson Harrison was offered a job as a Supreme Court justice, turned it down, and died shortly thereafter. So, I mean, Hamilton was one of a team. Of course, you know, even at the time, during the war, he was recognized as being either the chief aide or one of the chief aides of Washington. This is both Americans, the French, even the British recognized Hamilton's brilliance and how essential he was to Washington. And then,
yeah,
of course, later on, and, you know, during the first administration, you see Hamilton, you know, Secretary of the Treasury, basically Washington's prime minister.
Excellent. Well, you know, we're going to take a short break, and then we'll be back discussing Alexander Hamilton with Michael Newton, the author of Alexander Hamilton, The Formative Years. Thank you.
Do you enjoy hunting and fishing? Do you have pictures of your prize catch? Now through December, that's all you'll need to be entered in the Ram Trophy Room contest. Just go to the Ram Trophy Room at penswilds.com. Show off a little bit and submit your trophy picture, and you'll have a chance to win monthly prizes from Bosch, Steel, Mossy Oak, and more. And how about a grand prize from Under Armour? For official rules and more information, visit the Ram Trophy Room at penswilds.com.
Are you tired of looking up at that old, streaky, stained, tired, ugly roof? Tired of that ugly roof taking away from your home's curb appeal? GP Martini Roofing wants to solve your curb appeal woes with a new roof built with Atlas Pristine Shingles featuring Scotch Guard Protector from 3M. The only shingle with a lifetime limited warranty against algae streaks and stains. GP Martini's crews are highly trained professional installers of asphalt shingle roofs, and now with the power of Atlas Shingles and Scotchgard Protector from 3M, GP Martini will install a roof that will provide the lasting color you choose for as long as you're in your home. Let GP Martini Roofing have a look at that nagging leak, or just call to consult about upgrading the look for your prized investment. Call them today, 610-873-1696. Whether your need is residential or commercial, GP Martini Roofing has the expertise in-house to solve your problem, or to simply make your home or office look its best. 610-873-1696. That's the number to call. 610-873-1696. And one of those GP Martini trucks will be on its way to you.
Radio PA's Ask the Governor program brings you extended Q&As with Governor Tom Wolf, and you have a chance to be part of the show every month. Have a question or comment about taxes, government spending, or any other topic that impacts your life? Well, send your questions and comments to Governor Wolf anytime by visiting PAMatters.com and clicking the Ask the Governor link at the top of the page. We'll present your questions to Governor Wolf during every show. John in Mount Lebanon wrote in, when are the politicians going to Hanover Township for our next question? And Phil writes in, will people buying food with Wilkes-Barre is our next stop? Anthony, the award-winning Ask the Governor program from Radio Pennsylvania, now featuring Governor Tom Wolf. Visit PAMatters.com to have your voice heard and to view video clips from all our Ask the Governor tapings. Ask the Governor is a production of Radio PA, Top Flight Media, and PAMatters.com.
This is Governor Tom Wolf. I'm ready to answer your questions, so stop by PAMatters.com today.
You're listening to WCHE 1520 AM, the best radio station in America.
Wait, my check's gonna clear, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's right, the best station in America.
I'm Gene Pasale, and this is Living History. Today, we're talking with Michael Newton, the author of a great new book on Alexander Hamilton, entitled Alexander Hamilton, The Formative Years. Before we get going again, I want to remind people, if you have a question and you'd like to call in, the call-in line is 610-701-9243. Michael, you've done quite a bit of research on Hamilton, and your book kind of clears up some misperceptions about Hamilton that some people have had over the years. What do you think was the greatest misperception, aside from the discrepancy over what year he was born?
Well, that was going to be my answer. Of course, I only look at, in this book, I only look at the formative years, Alexander Hamilton, the formative years. There could be bigger misconceptions about later years. Besides the year he was born, I would say it's just in general, stories that are told of him that are, we'll say, secondhand or third-hand accounts that aren't true, or at least there's no evidence for it, especially as it pertains to battles.
Mm-hmm.
So there are accounts that Hamilton fought in the Battle of Long Island. They're not accounts. There are people who tell stories. There's no eyewitness accounts. There's no newspaper accounts that he did, that he fought in the Battle of White Plains, which is told actually by his son and by Washington Irving. Again, there's no evidence that it's true. If you actually find the accounts of those battles and you see what artillery was involved, then Hamilton's artillery was not involved. I mean, there's just a number of those, and some of these stories, you know, I wish they were true because it just adds Hamilton's glory.
Yeah.
But
sure.
You know, the most important thing is being factual and being accurate. Hamilton did so much anyway. I see no reason to embellish the accounts. And that's another thing. Even when you have him involved in a battle,
right,
you know he's there. People then embellish the story. And there's no reason to do that. And as a historian, just anybody who wants the truth, I think we have to be willing to admit that we don't know something and leave it at that.
Absolutely. You know, Hamilton and Washington, I call them comrades in arms for 4 years during the war. They survived some of the most difficult times during the combat. And I think they came to trust each other and had, in some ways, similar political philosophies. What are your views on their viewpoints or perspectives?
I think they had extremely similar political philosophies. When we're looking at the war period, where there was, I guess, a lot less politics because it was more military, they agreed on a Fabian strategy, which is that instead of, you know, having the American army of whatever, 10,000, go head-to-head with the British army of 10,000, which, of course, Washington and Hamilton knew the Americans weren't as well-trained and would lose that kind of battle, that you would have to have a Fabian strategy, which is slowly tire out the British, weaken the resolve, and win that way. And Hamilton actually proposed that strategy in February 1775, before the war even started, before Lexington and Concord. And Washington, even later in 1776, he did not favor that strategy. He favored an actual battle. Then, of course, in 1776, he realized that strategy would not be right. Jefferson, Thomas Paine, they continue to hold to that incorrect strategy when Hamilton and Washington were arguing for a Fabian strategy. The other big thing during the war was they believed in unity, in a union of the 13 states. If each individual state fought Britain alone, we would lose the American Revolution. Mm-hmm. If they united, worked together, they can win the American Revolution. Later, you know, when they're operating the first government, again, you see so much similarity in the political philosophies, economics, trade, foreign policy. Hamilton and Washington agree on virtually everything. Every major topic they agree on. They agree on almost every minor topic. You don't see that with Washington and Jefferson, even Washington and Madison, Washington and Adams. You don't. The two that are most similar are Washington and Hamilton.
Yeah, I think the fact that they were comrades in arms for 4 years forged in, kind of an unbreakable bond between the two men. And aside from the fact that James Madison and Thomas Jefferson, they were also quite brilliant, I think Washington simply trusted Hamilton over them and a lot of other advisors much of the time.
Well, like they say, they went through hell together. It does form a very close bond, and Washington had close bonds with many of the other aides and the other major generals, Knox, Greene, and of course many of the aides. Like I said, McHenry was later a Secretary of War. Actually, that was under Washington and Adams. They worked together, but it's more than just, becoming, you call comrades in arms, I call them brothers in arms. He gets to see their, besides their philosophy and their ability, he gets to see their character under stress. Jefferson, of course, was in Virginia as governor. Then he was in France. Forget whether they agreed or not, whether Jefferson agreed with Washington or not. Washington just wasn't able to see, wasn't able to get a feel. Hamilton, he knew. And even when he disagreed, he knew then that these are the kind of things I would disagree with Hamilton on. And then they wouldn't have to fight about it or anything. He would understand. He came with a notion of understanding the people he was dealing with, which made working together that much easier.
Yeah, I think a lot of people, and in general our listeners, may not be aware that all the heroes of the American Revolution that people commonly think of, like Thomas Jefferson or John Hancock or John Adams or Samuel Adams, those guys never picked up a rifle to fight on the front lines of the battle. And Hamilton was one of the few, aside from Washington and a few others, who actually did, who's counted as one of our founding fathers.
Well, in some cases, no fault of their own. I mean, Benjamin Franklin, of course, was whatever, 70-something. He wasn't going to fight. Others were effectively running governments. John Jay was an influential politician. I don't see why he would have gone to fight. William Livingston's another one I can think of. Then there were governors who fought, men like George Clinton, governor of New York. You really see John Adams fighting on the field. He was already a little older.
Probably not.
Certainly. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So, I can't fault them for that. But you do have some of those who became the Democratic Republicans who did fight on the field, like James Monroe.
Sure.
So I'm not going to, in some case, the problem is what they actually did. So if you're a politician, you're a governor, what did you actually do? Did you help promote the cause or did you hinder the cause? Did you, when the enemy was coming, did you organize an attack against them or did you run away? And I think that shows more than just the position they were in.
Sure. I believe the nation that we know today would not exist without the contributions of Alexander Hamilton. He was the only man at the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia in 1787 who had written and spoken eloquently, as you'd said before, about the fight for independence. He'd outlined specific recommendations to form the new government and a First Bank of the United States in Philadelphia, and who'd also fought on the front lines to secure these things. How do you personally rank Hamilton's importance versus, let's say, that of Washington, Jefferson, Adams, any of the others?
I think whenever you look at the American Revolution, Washington is always on top. Without Washington, there wouldn't have been a revolution, there wouldn't have been a constitution, there wouldn't have been a government. Many of these things were done just because everybody knew Washington would be the guy. We can make a president, you know, which is almost, you know, they saw it as like an elected monarch, because they all knew Washington would be the president. If it had been someone else, they might not have gone along with it. Washington, and of course everything Hamilton did, everything, you know, later, you know, Adams and Jefferson during the first administration, they all had to be approved by Washington. So the real question is, who do you rank next?
Yeah.
And I do rank Alexander Hamilton. If you look at the time period, we'll say, of the American Revolution, which we'll say from the time the fighting started in 1775, you can even say before, when people were arguing about, debating the issues, until the end of Washington's administration in 1796, who did more than anyone else? I mean, you really look at, like, Jefferson. He was he wrote the Declaration of Independence, but then he was away during most of the American Revolution, and then he was Secretary of State, where, you know, he came late, and Hamilton had to fill in. So he didn't do as much. Just Hamilton did more than anyone else, but also, as you said, he shaped the America we have now. All these ideas of, there wouldn't have been a Constitution without Hamilton. It wouldn't have been ratified without Hamilton. And then, once it's ratified, the real miracle is that it was effectively put into function, which, you know, many people, France had revolutions and constitutions, but they couldn't make them work. And Hamilton, as Washington's chief administrator, he made it work. So it's both the amount of stuff he did and the permanency of what he did, that I rank Hamilton number two, just under Washington.
I am in full agreement, and your book does an excellent job describing that. Hamilton's star seems to be rising. There's even a new play about Hamilton on Broadway, and your new book, and public awareness seems to be increasing regarding his important contributions to America. Any short closing comments on Hamilton?
Well, I do love the musical. There's also the issue, which I've seen, there's also the issue of removing Hamilton from the $10 bill. Of course, I oppose that.
I do, too.
The debate over it, again, is putting Hamilton in the news. More generally, the debates we're having on both sides of the aisle of what is the role of government, foreign affairs, those all come back to Hamilton, because Hamilton and whoever he was debating at the time, Madison or Jefferson or whoever else, those were the same issues they were debating, you know, 200 years ago, and we're still debating them. By understanding Hamilton and how he saw the government should function, we get a better insight into today of how the government should function today.
Thank you so much, Michael. It's been a pleasure talking with you. Michael's books are available on Amazon and also on his website, michaelenewton.com. Thank you all for joining us. Come next Wednesday, December 9th at 1 p.m., we'll be interviewing Jim Crist of Paoli Battlefield. Thank you all for joining us today for Living History.